I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Lawrence Zupan is a Manchester area real estate broker and businessman who's the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate. Zupan has been in real estate since moving from his native New York City to Vermont in 1986. Before that, he worked in businesses ranging from a nonprofit yoga institute to a food import-export company. Zupan says his experience in business should help him win your vote in November. He supports free opportunity for industry and opposes government regulation in sectors like broadband internet and healthcare. And he thinks he'd be a better choice for Vermont than incumbent Senator Bernie Sanders. As part of our ongoing coverage of Campaign 2018, Lawrence Zupan joins us today on Vermont Edition. Welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane. It's so good to be here.
Can you describe your Republican bona fides for us? What kind of Republican are you?
I'm a solutions Republican. In fact, the Republican part of who I am is secondary to the fact that I look for the best solutions to the problems we have. And I like to have my understanding always based in what's great and wonderful about our country. See, I grew up in a time when it was understood that we lived in the most wonderful country that a young person could grow up in. It was not challenged until the 60s when there were certain things that needed to be changed that were changed and addressed. In fact, I was a civil rights activist in my youth as well.
Yes. I was going to ask you to describe that. You said that in our earlier conversation before the primary. What kind of activism did you do? You described yourself as being an activist before you were a teenager.
That's right. Well, my family was, before they were Yankee, after they were Yankee fans, when Jackie Robinson came aboard the Brooklyn Dodgers, our whole family, and this was before I came along, switched over to the Brooklyn Dodgers. So I grew up in a family that was Brooklyn Dodgers because Jackie Robinson was a hero and he broke the color barrier. And he did it by overcoming all manner of challenges and showed tremendous courage. So when I grew up at age 4, 5, 6 as a Brooklyn Dodger fan, by the way, which might be one of the only things I have in common with Senator Sanders, Jackie Robinson was my hero. So then as I came to understand the color barriers that stood in the way of full citizenship rights for people who weren't white, that became my personal cause célèbre. So, and there were ample opportunities in New York City to demonstrate and express one's views. Like at, I remember in the 80s, I had a meeting again with the director of CORE, and we kind of high-fived each other because back in 1961, we were both picketing the White Castle, which discriminated against black people. So I was very happy to see the evolution. And of course, the real evolution happens in people's hearts. The government has a role to play in civil rights. But the real transformation is in the hearts and minds and attitudes of individuals. So it's great that we set the stage in our families and in our homes to love and respect people. And that's where it all starts. And I think that's going to be the solution, long-term solution, for a lot of the inequities that we may face and think that the government is the one to solve the problem.
Do you support Donald Trump?
Allow me to just go back because I don't feel I gave you the fullest answer that you deserved in your other good question about what kind of Republican I am. I'm a Republican who loves the United States of America, who always has loved the United States of America, and always will love the United States of America. A sentence, by the way, which I invite Senator Sanders to repeat anytime he feels so inclined.
Are you suggesting that you don't think Senator Sanders loves the United States of America?
I am suggesting that he loves a system that's anathema and foreign to our system more, as defined by his love and his promulgation of socialism at every single drop of the hat wherever he goes.
And you think that's un-American?
I do, and I'll tell you why. Enshrined in the Declaration of Independence in the United States Constitution are the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the rights of the individual to own and protect his own property, his own life, and his well-being. Socialism comes along, and by the way, it's failed in all 39 countries it's been tried in. So a score of 39-0 would not be what I would invite us to consider for the United States of America. When socialism enters the civic life of a nation, what it does is it centralizes power and direction and control of resources and the fruits of resources into the government's hands, which in their all-knowing wisdom, they deign to decide who gets what. That is totally anathema and unworkable and is the exact opposite of what has made us the greatest country in the history of the world. Our country, Jane, inarguably, although some might try to, has fed, housed, clothed, with security, more people than any other country in the history of the world. And it's done so while sharing its abundance with other countries and while becoming the envy of the civilized world and a role model for so many countries that have followed our success.
But isn't a lot of that because of social safety net programs that come from taxes, that come from the United States saying we will support people who can't work?
I think you have it exactly backwards. I think you have it exactly. We have been able to have the luxury of some social safety net programs because we generated enough prosperity to be able to have those kinds of experiments, some of which are good and some of which are not so good.
Let's go right into it. Which ones are not so good? What would you get? What taxes, what programs would you get rid of in order to lower taxes, which you'd like to do?
I'd rather say which programs have suffered from the mismanagement, which is endemic to the government's way of doing things. I'll back up to tell you.
But I'd like you to do that. But also, you said some of these basically in concept are wrong. So which of them are wrong? Which social safety net programs should we get rid of?
There's none of them in their entirety that we should get rid of. Let me say that. But there's many of them that have been expanded to the point of unreasonability and together with corruption and fraud and mismanagement have taxed the taxpayer unreasonably.
Which ones?
And giving, well, our whole welfare system, our whole medical system. I mean, in the same week that our venerable Senator Sanders was recommending Medicare for all, almost in the same hour, the Congressional Budget Office announced the coming insolvency of Medicare and Social Security by 2026. Now, am I saying we shouldn't have Medicare and Social Security? No. But I'm saying the way that the government manages anything should be very instructive to all thinking Americans before we give them full reign over 13% of the nation's economy, which is what the healthcare system is. Because, I mean, just take, you know.
On healthcare, for example, yeah. Do you think the government is incapable in the way it's currently structured of running that program well? Or do you believe that healthcare is not a human right and should not be something that the government's involved in? Like, what's the fundamental philosophy behind
your view? Yes and yes. Okay, first of all, the government pays 320 times more than private enterprise to blast a rocket off. We have socialized medicine. We have a very profound and long-term experiment in socialized medicine existing in the country. It's called the VA. The Veterans Administration owns the facilities, hires the doctors, and it has an absolute monopoly on the health care for the veterans who choose to come there. And it's largely a failure when you have waiting periods where our esteemed veterans who put their lives on the line, who wrote a blank check to America, up to and including their very lives, have to die waiting for medical care. That's beyond the scandal. That's something that we have to get in there and tear it wide open and rebuild it. And I have a lot of ideas about how that can be done. But before I get to those, this is a clear example of how the Veterans Administration is an example of how government can't do anything as well as private enterprise.
But the philosophy is what I just want to get. I just want to understand your perspective on whether it's that it's not being run well, or we shouldn't be doing it?
Well, both.
Okay.
Succinctly, the answer is both. Now, I'll tell you why we shouldn't be doing it, but the fact that it's not being run well just confirms the fact that the government shouldn't be doing it.
Got it.
Look, you see this cell phone that I turned off before I came in here?
Well done.
Okay. If we left it up to Bernie Sanders to design the cell phone like he wants to design the healthcare system, we'd still be looking for the nearest telephone booth. Come on now. You know how we got the cell phone? And you know how we're going to get the best healthcare system in the world? By unleashing free, liberty-loving, creative minds to design a system that works with free competition. That way, we'll not only get a telephone that is the product of the century, the smartphone, but we'll get a healthcare system that goes above and beyond what we've tried to promise before. You know, there's a lot of good news on the horizon. And that good news is something that the American people and the people of Vermont really deserve to know about. Because of the digital age, which is just about – it's the greatest invention since ink and scroll. Ink and scroll basically allowed humans to codify and transmit the information, the learning, and the knowledge of their forebears, ancestors, and pass it on to others, the next generation. Amazing. The internet is greater than ink and scroll because what it does is it takes the sum of all the human knowledge that have existed and combines it and makes it widely available to those who would use it to research and develop new things that will benefit humanity. In, for example, the genome. It took 10 years and $1 billion to do the first genome, which is a DNA map of the human body. Now it can be done for $100, and soon it'll be for less than the cost of your morning shower.
So are you suggesting net neutrality then should be regulated as a good thing because everybody should have access to the same internet?
You have the right idea, the wrong solution, in my estimation. Okay, the concept of net neutrality gives the heavy hand of government even more control over the most powerful intellectual and lifestyle weapon in the history of the world. I say keep the government out of it, but have it ubiquitously available to every, particularly Vermonters. If I have the privilege of going to Washington as the senator for the people of Vermont, one of the first things I'll be championing is the five different companies contesting for the opportunity to send satellites over the country to give us a wide pipe broadband, which will give us internet and cell phone like we never even imagined. Spreadsheets in a second, movies in a second, everything you need in a second. We need to bring that to Vermont because just think, I mean, it's amazing, Jane, how wonderful this can be for Vermonters. Just think what Vermont will be like when the amazing beauty that we have, the natural beauty, which is already a magnet and something that makes us want to come here and stay here, is matched by the ability to start all of our high school and college grads who are fleeing the state for lack of opportunity stay here because every little village and hamlet throughout the state has wide pipe broadband and they can access and start their own little nucleus, new business, 3, 4, 5 people. And the echo niche of prosperity that ramifies out in the town and area because of that will transform Vermont. Vermont can be to this nation what the Canton of Zug is to Switzerland. But even better, because they didn't do it with the internet. They did it by lowering taxes. So by lowering
taxes. That's your favorite, right? You talk about the Canton of Zug on your website. One of the few things you talk about. Lawrence, let me stop you for just a minute because we're going to take a break. And I've led you down, we've sort of zigged and zagged through multiple paths here. But luckily, we've touched on a lot of the issues that we want to discuss. So I'm going to give our listeners a chance to ask you questions as well when we come back. We're talking with Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, Lawrence Zupan. Let's go to Colin, who's calling in from Morrisville. Hello, Colin.
Hi, this is Colin. Thanks for having me. Just wondering, I'm just disappointed, to be honest, about intellectual dishonesty vis-a-vis calling Bernie Sanders a socialist when he's a democratic socialist. This is apples and oranges. This is just ridiculous to hear. It's, what do we call, red herring?
Yeah, Colin, let me put that to Lawrence Zupan. Lawrence Zupan, you talk about socialism, you talk about Bernie Sanders. When you and I talked before in July, you talked about Democrats and independents who want to eliminate ICE and said this would eliminate all border protection, which it wouldn't. So what about this sort of twisting of ideas or you know, Colin says it's intellectual dishonesty.
Well, then Colin ought to define the differentiation between the two terms that he feels have been twisted.
Colin, you want to do that?
It's in the dictionary. It's in, look up Wikipedia, look at any resource he wants to use will define them as two different things. It's just hilarious.
Colin, thanks for your comment. Lawrence Zupan, you want to say anything else?
Sure. My understanding about the purported differentiation between the two, which I believe is mostly a clever euphemistic trick in order to make the poison go down more easily, is that people vote in the socialist that then will gradually encroach on the entire economy of the United States of America. One way or another, poison is poison. Socialism, whether it's glorified with the somewhat dubiously earned term of democratic or not, is still socialism. And I want to say this about socialism. Socialism, just like America and its economic liberty and its constitutional foundation has provided the most prosperous country in the history of the world, fed, housed, and clothed more people than any in the history of the world. Socialism has killed, destroyed, and stolen and caused more human misery in the shortest amount of time than any other system in the history of the world. So excuse me, Colin, if I'm doubling down on my previous remarks, but that's exactly what I'm doing.
What exactly are you referencing?
I'm referencing socialism. What I'm referencing, look at the history of the 20th century and look at how many people have been killed, whether it's national socialism, Soviet socialism, communism, socialism.
Communism and socialism are two different things.
I meant Soviet socialism, Cuban socialism, all of these socialisms.
The Cubans is a communist system.
Yeah, and they'll be happy to call themselves socialists too if it helps them to market themselves better to the politicians in Florida who will help get more money sent back to them to keep the whole country from falling into the ocean.
But communism and socialism are two different movements. Are you conflating the two? Are you trying to scare people away from something that is – I mean, you could equally point to other countries that have a socialism bent. Maybe they don't call themselves socialists in exactly the same way, but have a much deeper social safety net, have much more government control. I mean, you can point to different movements and say, this is my point, but that doesn't encompass the whole history of a specific movement or a specific political viewpoint.
It's true, but you'll notice that the United Soviet Socialist Republic didn't call themselves the United Soviet Communist Republic. And at a certain point in practice, the two become somewhat indistinguishable. And it's very convenient to try to separate the two. Communism's evil, but socialism is good. They are basically stepsisters.
Let's go to Athena calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Athena. You're on the air.
Hey there. Just a quick question because you asked it before but was never answered. And I don't want a song and dance with specific vocabulary, just a yes or no answer. Do you support Kavanaugh? Yes or no? And if it's a yes or no, why?
Athena, thanks for the question. I just want to to defend Lawrence Zupan here. I hadn't asked him that question yet. I said we would make sure we get to talk about Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who is up, of course, for a confirmation for a position as a Supreme Court justice. So what about Athena's question? She wants a yes or no. Do you support Brett Kavanaugh?
I'm glad that she's allowing me the opportunity to expand about why. And the answer is yes, and I'll tell you why. We are a nation where there is the presumption of innocence, and if someone is accused of something, the presumption of innocence has to be overridden by corroborating evidence and a conviction of same. In a court of law. Now, I know that the Supreme Court hearing wasn't a court of law, but I also know that the American people have a sense of fairness. Now, I listened to Miss Blasey Ford.
Christine Blasey Ford.
I listened to her testimony, and I did find her a very credible witness. I listened to Judge Kavanaugh, and I found him a very credible witness. I'm not God. I don't know the truth. But I do know that there is no corroborated evidence supporting her allegations, and I know that there's a lot of ways that a person can be sure about something, completely sure about something, and also be completely wrong.
And one of them is.
And one of them clearly.
And you believe that she is the one who's wrong.
Yes, I do. And I'm not God, and I don't know the truth, but I do know we have the presumption of innocence. And I'll tell you something else. The American people have a sense of fairness. So let me ask you, how fair is the following thing? Within an hour of the naming of Judge Kavanaugh as the candidate for confirmation, they had the banners all ready, everything all set. All they did is fill in the blank, no good, condemn him. They already judged him within an hour.
By they, you mean?
Everybody on the Democratic side, it seemed, was out in force to condemn whoever was going to get nominated. Now, I remember when Judge Ginsburg was confirmed, and I remember a lot of the and it was a much more courtly world. And the senators who even disagreed with her judicial philosophy revered and respected her credentials and the fact that she was chosen by the president. And she won by something like 80-6 or 90-5, some over. And I long for the days of civility.
What about the Neil Gorsuch nomination process?
The Neil Gorsuch, it was a lot more civil than what we're seeing now.
That was a Trump nominee.
Yeah. So, but at the same time, they spent a lot of time trying to dig up their. I guess they felt that They ran out of ways to try to attack the candidate, but they tried everything they could. They just ran out of ways. So, you know, and Judge Kavanaugh and his family and his reputation, even if he's confirmed, will never recover from this onslaught and this assault on his character. And these other quasi so-called witnesses that have come forward of dubious reputation, I mean, really, the American people are outraged because American people have a sense of fairness and justice. And you look at Mr. Kavanaugh's record for the last 20 or 30 years and his six previous investigations by the FBI, he's had an impeccable record of service. So that's about all I want to say, because there are more important things to talk about for the people of Vermont, because I'm not going to get to vote on Judge Kavanaugh anyway.
So let me ask you about tariffs, and certainly we could talk more about Kavanaugh. We could talk more about all of the things that we've been discussing with you, but I want to make sure we cover the waterfront a little bit so people have a sense of your stance on different issues. You and I talked in July, I think it was, June or July, in advance of the primary. Mm-hmm. And we talked about tariffs, which were quite new then. And you said that you generally don't like the idea of government-imposed tariffs at all. But in this case, you were sort of open to the idea that maybe tariffs were necessary on steel and aluminum and perhaps on other things. Now that we've had a couple months to look at where this is going, and certainly at trade with China, which you're familiar with mm-hmm. from your previous experience mm-hmm. as a food importer, what do you think? Working well?
Well, I think the jury is still out. I would reiterate my support for the gesture in the first place, because I've watched for the last 25 years in trade treaties, the United States of America being the weak man at the table. And I'm saying to myself all this time, why are we getting pushed around in trade negotiations by these other countries? By China, by the European Union, by Russia? Why are we Mr. Nice Guy all the time and getting stepped on? What do we have to prove that we really care by letting other people step on us? No. That's why I like the fact, whether this tariff experiment works out well or not, I like the fact that President Trump has rolled up his sleeve and showed an American bicep to the world and said, guess what? You're not going to step on our face anymore. You're not going to take advantage of us. And if you want new trade treaties, there's a new sheriff in town. And I think that that's exactly what America needed, whether and I'm not a President Trump cult supporter, but I'm telling you what I think of this action. Now, I would hasten to add that I think that there's a shelf life for the tariffs, and we have to be gradually weaned from it, because free trade, which is truly on an equal playing field where we're treated fairly, is going to benefit all the countries of the world, but most particularly the United States of America.
So how did then you get to that weaning off or backing down? Is it new trade partnerships? Is it some kind of treaty? I mean, we're not seeing a backing down right now. We're seeing an increasing tit for tat with many of our trading partners.
You may have noticed there's renegotiation of NAFTA with Mexico and Canada, and I think you already hit it a moment ago. There's a renegotiation. Once they know that they can't continue exploiting us as they have in the past, they will come to the table. And when they come to the table, we'll have a new, fair, America-centric negotiation. Let's face it, you know, there's nothing wrong with being America-centric if you represent America. I mean, please, if you are a representative, if you are a trade representative, if you are a senator, if you are a congressman, if you are the president, you have to be America-centric. The other countries, you know that they're centric to their country, as well they should. We have to be strong in representing the people of the United States of America who send us to Washington. And if I have this glorious opportunity, that's exactly what I'll do. I'll be a full-time servant senator to the people of Vermont. I will not be dancing around Iowa, Georgia, Florida, California, telling all of those states what's wrong with them and running for president and using Vermont as a stepping stone to another office. I'll be fully dedicated to the needs and concerns of every citizen in the state of Vermont.
So what issues in Vermont do you think are the most pressing that perhaps aren't getting enough attention or that you would really be focused on dealing with and addressing from a national perspective in Washington?
Well, we've already touched on some of them. It's health, it's education, and the economy. And all of those are somewhat interrelated, and they include other subtopics like taxation and regulation. We have this opportunity, as I started to talk about with the Canton of Zug, we have this opportunity to make Vermont even outsized to its out of proportion to its tiny size of 640,000 people and its small land mass.
623, I think.
Oh, see, that's the problem. It's shrinking. Okay, we need to be the place that people really want to come. They want to come not only to stay for a weekend or a week, but they want to come because it's so beautiful and they can build a business here without the strong arm of government overly restricting and overly taxing them so that they go across the Connecticut River to New Hampshire or they go out to Colorado or down to Texas or Florida. We need to be a magnet for all of and the opportunity is greater than it ever has been before because of the digital age and the fact that you don't need smokestack industries to come to Vermont to make us great. You can have all these low carbon footprint, easy businesses to incorporate into a village or a town come here and grow. And all of the old mom and pops that are starting to maybe get a little worn around the edges can be reinvigorated by the presence of new blood building their fresh, new, great idea businesses in our towns, in our villages. And that can be a Vermont renaissance like we've never seen before. And I am a champion of that, both as a businessman and as a Vermonter and as someone who understands the opportunities in the digital age.
So would you support more incentives or subsidies for renewable energy producers, for solar installers, people who want to have solar in their home? Would there be government subsidies and incentives for that?
I think if we get out of the way and watch the advances in solar energy and in other forms of renewability, that not only will we not need to subsidize them, we need to just allow ourselves to enjoy the benefit of how well they are replacing fossil fuels. You know, Senator Sanders, Governor Scott, other people have talked about becoming completely on renewables by 2050. I think that if we find the ways to champion the technologies that are emerging right now, we can be rid of fossil fuels if we choose to be by 2035. And it's not going to be by draining the taxpayer and forcing them to subsidize industries that cannot stand on their own two feet.
Or presumably pay a carbon tax. I assume you're not in favor of a carbon tax.
Am I not only not in favor of a carbon tax, I'm scandalized that anyone who's a Vermonter who represents hardworking taxpayers would even think about adding 89 cents a gallon to the fuel that drives our Vermont people to work and that heats our Vermont people's homes.
Who's suggesting that high of a tax, 89 cents on a gallon?
That's what I've been reading and hearing. I don't know exactly who, but that's what I've been reading and hearing. The carbon tax, the Beatles song, you know, you try to walk, I'll tax the street. You try to drive, I'll tax your feet. I got that backwards. that's the government. The government is a big, fat, green taxing machine, okay? The government needs to shrink and it needs to mind more of its own business and its increasingly less amount of that business and let the Vermonters and the people of America mind their business for themselves. This is the way we became the greatest country that ever was, and this is the way we will be again.
Let's take another call here from George in Waterbury. Hi, George. You got a new topic for us?
Yes, I do, sir. I back your kind of essential Republican stance. I'm very concerned about the irony of the bailout in the 2008 scandal, virtually that nearly brought the financial structure of our country to its knees. And I like to straight talk about things, and I'm very afraid that when we heard the big banks, we can't let those be too big to fail. Well, guess what, sir? They're bigger now than they ever were.
Right.
And I'm fearful about how things are going.
Yes.
Because of that, and we don't address it, and it is a potentially a good old boys club in
yep.
both sides of the party
mm-hmm.
are dealing with this, and that is a potential problem. As much as and that influences, the structure of our retirement funds and both the teachers fund because they're relying on that stock market to subsidize the equity in their investments.
So, George, let me give it over
question.
To Lawrence Zupan
yeah.
here. Do you have a specific question, or do you just want him to address that issue of the banks?
I do have a comment.
Of how he would deal with that?
Okay, George. Thanks.
Okay,
Lawrence?
So. The 2008 biggest lie was that these companies, Lehman Brothers and Goldman's, Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail. Goldman Sachs, Citibank were too big to fail. In my estimation, we should have let them fail, just like we should clean out a wound when we damage our arm, clean it out, disinfect it, bandage it up, and let it heal. Because now, as you rightly point out, those too big to fail banks have gotten even bigger. And if we try to bail them out again, there won't be enough money to bail them all out. So what we need is we need sound fiscal policy. We need to not make any industry through cronyism sacrosanct to the end that the American taxpayer has to take it on the chin for their misdeeds, which is what they did in making ill-advised loans in all through the early 2000s, which defaulted, which caused the too-big-to-fail crisis. Also, the other thing that no politician really enjoys talking about because it's not fun and sexy is the fact that we spend too much money. If you spent more money than you had 3 months in a row, you would be thrown out of your house, or 6 months in a row if you didn't have reserves. We don't have real reserves unless we print them. And we're spending more each year by almost $1 trillion than we produce. That's something that has to change for the long-term solvency and even existential life of our nation.
And you would work to do that in Congress?
I would.
That's Lawrence Zupan, Republican nominee for U.S. Senate. Lawrence, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. And may I say, ZupanForSenate.org if you'd like to learn more about what I have to offer the people of Vermont. And thank you so much.
And we have a link to his website at vpr.net as well if you're driving and didn't catch that. And you can hear our interview with the incumbent, Bernie Sanders, on Thursday, October 11th. This is part of our series of interviews on Vermont Edition and elsewhere on VPR, talking with statewide candidates for office ahead of the general election in now just over a month.